From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. After fighting ISIS in Iraq, Navy SEAL Edward Gallagher was named top platoon leader in SEAL Team 7 and nominated for the military's third highest honor. Now the Navy has charged the Special Operations Chief, who served in combat deployments for 19 years, with war crimes, among them murder. Gallagher denies all charges. When New York Times national correspondent Dave Phillips began reporting the story, he thought Gallagher must have suffered some kind of psychotic break as the result of many deployments. But what Phillips has found through interviews and military documents defied expectations. Dave Phillips joins me now on the line from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
So who is Eddie Gallagher?
Even amongst the SEALs, who are an elite group of people, he was one of the top. A 19-year career that was sprinkled with all sorts of awards for valor and good leadership. He was a medic, a sniper, an explosives expert, knew almost everything there was about being an elite warrior, and for years was also an instructor at the SEALs training school, which is called BUDS. So he was a person with a huge personality, and he was a legend within the SEALs, highly respected.
What kind of charges does he face now?
A host of charges. The big one is premeditated murder. Also a couple of attempted murders, obstruction of justice, drug possession. There had been a couple smaller charges for allegedly taking photos and video of one of the men that he killed. Those were dropped. But if he's convicted just of the murder, he's facing life in prison.
Who's brought these charges against him?
So that's what's interesting. The SEALs is a really closed group of people, and we know very little about them as journalists. But the charges were brought by his own men. He was a platoon leader in charge of about 20 other SEALs, and what they saw on their most recent deployment to Mosul, Iraq, where they were helping to clear ISIS fighters out of the city, they said was murder, and they came home and very clearly said that to their chain of command.
Specific cases of murder.
That's right.
Well, so when you first learned about the charges, you tried to interview some of these, seven commandos, I think, brought the charges?
Yes, about that many.
Did they talk?
No, none of them talked, which is not uncommon. Even if SEALs are not involved in a murder investigation, their culture is not one where, while they're actively serving, they talk about it or even admit they exist. Add in that now their own chief is getting investigated, and that makes things really sensitive.
When Gallagher's family, on the other hand, has been outspoken about his record, you even interviewed some of them. But let's listen to one. This is Eddie Gallagher's brother, Sean, on Fox News.
If you were to literally create or imagine what a modern-day war hero would be, it'd be Eddie. Now, he's just like any other special operator. He's humble. He would say that I'm just like the rest of the guys. But even among his peers, he stands out.
Sean Gallagher went on to call the charges against his brother fake news. And you, David, spoke with his family. What did they tell you?
I was really hoping that they would speak to me, and lucky enough that they did, because I wanted to understand more about his time in the SEALs leading up to when things allegedly went wrong. You know, had he been wounded in some way? Had he been treated for post-traumatic stress disorder? Were there warning signs along the way that maybe here was a guy who, after numerous combat deployments, was wearing out? And what was interesting is his wife said, emphatically, no.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie is a total professional. He is used to this type of stuff. He thrives on it. He knew exactly what he's doing. And she said, essentially, I've never seen any signs of any sort of injury like that. And what she said really startled me. I was looking for an explanation of then how this could happen. And she said, it didn't happen. What happened is that Eddie Gallagher is such a demanding boss, a man with such high standards, that the men serving under him in Iraq didn't like him, couldn't meet his standards. And so they started concocting a plan to get him out. They figured if we can make allegations against him, he'll be removed. And she said that's what happened. Essentially, this is all lies made up by the men who serve under him.
Well, you filled a lot of that information out by obtaining more than 400 pages of confidential documents from the Navy's criminal investigation. What did that report include? And I'm wondering about specifics. When you talk about premeditated murder, did he assassinate someone without an order from the top?
Yeah. So this was sort of unprecedented because within this report is summaries of interviews with more than a dozen SEALs. So we were able to hear the SEALs we weren't able to speak to. And what comes out is they say that he repeatedly showed just complete disregard for both the men in the platoon and civilians in the city. He would spray neighborhoods with heavy machine gun fire with no apparent targets. He would fire shoulder-launched rockets into houses for no clear reason. And there were specific cases where they say he killed people in cold blood, specifically three instances. In two of them, he spent a lot of time in a hidden sniper nest where he would shoot targets in the city. And other snipers said that at times he also shot a young unarmed girl and an old man and killed them. Yeah. And then the last one, the one that he faces premeditated murder charges for, is a stabbing. And that is a case where there had been a firefight. Iraqi troops brought in a ISIS fighter who was probably somewhere between 14 and 17 years old. This fighter had been wounded in the fight but was still conscious, and the SEAL started rendering medical aid to him, as is expected in their rules of engagement. He's lying on the ground getting medical aid from a medic and a couple other SEALs when the SEALs say Chief Gallagher came over and stabbed this fighter in the neck and torso and killed him. And so he's facing charges of premeditated murder for that captive's death.
We're learning from Dave Phillips. He covers military and veteran affairs for the New York Times about the case of Navy SEAL Special Operations Chief Eddie Gallagher, whom the Navy has charged with war crimes. And those are grave charges indeed. But what did these documents reveal about the internal process for investigating these types of allegations? I understand those who brought the charges initially got a lot of pushback and were told, do not talk about this.
You know, I think for me, as somebody who's reported on the military for years, this was the most eye-opening thing. The type of thing that normally is extremely difficult to report because these communities are so insular. So within this trove of documents, yes, the SEALs who are interviewed all talk about how they witnessed their chief stab this ISIS captive, or how they witnessed him shooting up neighborhoods and shooting at civilians. But they also talk about how they tried to report it. First, they tried to report it to their immediate officer, the guy who's just in charge of the platoon. And they were kind of brushed off. What they tell us is they told investigators, he responded, yeah, okay, I'll take care of it. But after months, they realized that he wasn't taking care of it at all. And so they hoped that when they got home from this deployment in late 2017, they could take it up with the next level of chain of command. And there they did the same thing. They said, here are the things we saw. This guy is a real problem. We need you to do something. Same type of response. Okay, we'll take care of it, but don't report this farther up. And they got frustrated because over months they realized that no one was taking care of anything. What they saw is that their chief seemed to be being allowed to get away with what they say was murder. And they went back repeatedly to their chain of command and were told, you know, hey, just don't worry about it or decompress. They were warned this could ruin your careers and take down a lot of other SEALs. Now, here's what we don't know, what we can't tell from the documents is the tenor of this. Is the leadership worried because they think this whole thing is going to blow up in the faces of young SEALs and they're trying to protect these guys so they can go on and have a career and live their lives? or are they trying to protect someone who is a beloved and well-known peer? That's unclear. But certainly what the SEALs who tried to report this say to investigators is they left with the impression that they were supposed to stop talking about it.
Yeah. Chief Gallagher does go on trial in May, and you wrote in the Times that the outcome is anything but clear. Gallagher's family has attempted to discredit the younger Navy SEALs who reported him, the charges, and the Navy prosecutors who have brought them as well. Gallagher's brother, Sean, again, also said the case has created a morale issue for the military. Here's what he told Fox News.
This is ripping the military community apart. This is a morale issue.
Oh, yeah.
They're looking at this and saying, well, if it can happen to Eddie with his service record, it can happen to me.
Well, this is the big question here. The Navy SEALs, of course, this elite force, have done amazing work in the theater of war, but their reputation has been somewhat tarnished in past years. What do you think is going on there? And tell us a little bit about those cases and how morale is now in this fighting force.
Well, there have been a handful of high-profile cases where Navy SEALs are getting investigated for theft, for drug use, for illegal deaths, for murder. And that has caused the leadership to publicly announce, hey, we're going to step back and we're going to look at culture. We're going to look at training because we think there is a problem here. And what SEALs have told me is there's sort of a tension within this community. This is a community of Navy personnel that view themselves as very much outside of the Navy. They do something different. They work by their own rules. And to some extent, there's a subculture in there who are called the pirates, who feel like they need to be a little bit above the rules because they do a dirty job that no one else can do. And there's a swagger and a respect afforded to guys who are in that subculture in the SEALs. You know, they're seen as the bad boys who are going to get stuff done. And there's another side within the SEALs that says, no, that's really dangerous. That's a slippery slope, and it's not who we are. We are an organization that needs to, by the very nature of our work, follow rules very closely. And there is a clash that I think we see playing out here. You know, people described Eddie Gallagher to me as a bit of a pirate. And obviously the men who turned him in didn't feel like he was acting as he should. Now, those men have received a lot of blowback in the SEAL community, both active duty and veterans. I think to some, they're seen as traitors. Mm. And so we're seeing this fight play out of what is the duty of a SEAL? Is it to obey the letter of the law, or is it to stand by the other men that they went to war with?
Dave, we're going to be speaking with a clinician in just a minute. I know we have to let you go in a couple of minutes, but hope you'll hang on with us. You mentioned PTSD and Gallagher's wife telling you that PTSD was not a factor. But you recently reported that the military wants better tests for PTSD. What kind of options are being explored? And I'm sorry, we have just 30 seconds. We can pick this up after.
Yeah, there's all sorts of options. It used to be you had to talk to people to figure out if they had PTSD, a psychologist. Now we're starting to look at actual laboratory tests that might be able to give, you know, a positive result so that they can get treatment.
That's New York Times national correspondent Dave Phillips covering military and veterans affairs. Please stay with us for just a moment. We're going to be back with Liza Zweibeck. She's in the studio to help us understand more about PTSD. She's associate clinical director at Emory Healthcare Veterans Program. Stay with us. This is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Any thoughts? Join our Facebook conversation. Our Facebook group is GPB Radio's On Second Thought. We'll be back. We are back with On Second Thought from GPB. I'm Virginia Prescott. Georgia is home to hundreds of thousands of military veterans and boasts tens of thousands of active duty and reserve personnel. And with those numbers often comes four letters, PTSD. Well, later in the show, we're going to talk about a play about how the effects of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, play out in one couple. Symptoms range from nightmares to those as severe as suicidal thoughts. But first, we've got Dave Phillips still with us. He covers military and veterans affairs. stars for the New York Times. Liza Zwieback is with us in the studio to help us understand more about PTSD. She is Associate Clinical Director at the Emory Healthcare Veterans Program. Hello, Liza.
Hi.
All right, Dave, I just want to, I know we have just a couple minutes with you, so I want to pick up on what we were talking about earlier. The Navy was sued last year over alleged discrimination against veterans with PTSD by the Naval Discharge Review Board. This board rejects nearly 85% of requests from upgraded benefits relating to PTSD. This is compared with 45% in the Army. So what came of this case?
You got me on that one. So there's been a real problem with these boards in looking at PTSD and approving it. And I think it underlies a bigger issue, is that the military and the VA have a real difficult time saying what is PTSD and what is not definitively.
Yeah,
and there are people, patients, who will downplay their symptoms, and there are people who will exaggerate their symptoms for various reasons. And so it leaves clinicians and the government, who I think probably want to do a decent job of defining this, kind of in the dark.
Liza's she's nodding her head here. What do you want to say?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It is very hard, I think, to agree on what is a PTSD diagnosis, kind of from person to person. And I think it's very often the case, as being said, that there may be disagreement in whether a particular person has PTSD or does not.
We're going to pick up with Liza in just a minute, but Dave, before you go, I want to ask about your reporting you've done on some innovative treatments for PTSD. Last year, in fact, reporting on a new study that shows that the street drug ecstasy could be a promising treatment for PTSD. What's in that study?
First, let me just say, don't go out and try ecstasy and think that it's going to work.
But note and point taken.
For years, there has been interest in the idea of guided therapy, where oftentimes a patient will have trouble accessing the events, thinking about the events, understanding the events that are causing trauma. And so if you can flood their brain with chemicals that enable trust and well-being, which ecstasy does, then maybe you can allow them to see those facts and those emotions and try to process them. And so there have been experiments. They're now in, I believe, their phase 3 trials for FDA approval to look at, okay, if we have therapists guiding people through this process, can it help? And what the data shows is it helps a lot. And so you would take 2, maybe 3 doses of this over several months, and that would be it. It's not like taking a pill every day. And through those therapy sessions would hopefully recognize and begin to process things as part of a larger psychotherapy regimen.
So in conjunction with therapy, the psychiatrist and the MacArthur Genius Grant winner, Jonathan Shea, he said that PTSD doesn't encompass all of the challenges active military and veterans face in their recovery from trauma. He calls it moral injury, and that is his real concern. Here he is.
If it gets bad enough, especially in moral injury, as I define it, betrayal of what's right by someone with legitimate authority in a high-stakes situation, then the character begins to change. One's social and moral horizon shrinks, sometimes just to oneself, or it shrinks to a tiny little circle. It might be just one squad.
Dave, how mainstream is this notion of moral injury?
I think a lot of veterans have heard about it, and a lot of civilians have not, you know, but the point is really important that we use in the civilian world PTSD as sort of a catch-all for the things that might affect someone during war. And I think that there's all sorts of things. PTSD is a small part of it. And so treatment is probably much broader than just talking about PTSD. How do you give someone who's come back from combat a meaningful life once they have, you know, maybe seen and done things that they can't abide by? And I think that's what Jonathan Shea has thought a lot about, is we need to broaden how we think about this injury and how we're going to address it. And a lot of times that's a lot of stuff outside of the therapy office.
Dave Phillips, thank you so much for your time, and we'll be watching for your reporting on that case. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your time.
Dave Phillips, he's New York Times national correspondent covering military and veteran affairs. Liza, so back to you. This idea of the moral injury, do you think that we do hear PTSD a lot and we hear about its symptoms? We know a lot more about the brain now, but is that idea of the moral injury that it is something we flatten things out when we say this is PTSD?
Yeah. So the term moral injury actually has been catching on quite a lot in recent years. I think is very catchy for lots of reasons. I think it captures a dimension that kind of, as you're saying, the sort of flat kind of abbreviation PTSD maybe doesn't seem to capture in people's minds. However, you know, you don't always get complete agreement on what moral injury is either, right? And to me, moral injury, really, a lot of it amounts to guilt and shame over one's actions, right? In war, also in, you know, in civilian cases where people experience trauma and develop PTSD, they will also have kind of what, you know, what some people might consider moral injury in terms of, you know, feeling guilt and shame over having done something, over having, you know, not done something. But as far as I'm concerned, that guilt and shame actually can be part of successful PTSD treatment. And so I'm a little bit less aligned with the idea that moral injury is something separate. I think moral injury, you know, as I think people are conceptualizing it, has always been part of not only PTSD, but kind of PTSD treatment.
Mm-hmm. So guilt and shame are part of the effects of PTSD?
Yes, they're actually symptoms of PTSD.
So how do you treat that?
That is a great question. Well, so, you know, I think particularly if we're talking about veterans, people who have acted in ways in the context of a war that don't necessarily comport with their own moral code, a lot of it comes down to contextualizing, right? And so this idea that we behave differently in a war zone mm-hmm. than we do in our normal lives. I'm oversimplifying it, of course, mm-hmm. but you know, I think as the course of treatment unfolds, we kind of see you know, our patients sort of unpacking and exploring their memories of what happened and kind of being able to incorporate more of the context of what was going on and what actually may have contributed mm-hmm. to their acting in the way that they did. And
as Jonathan Chay said, you have legitimate authority, a high stakes situation. Somebody's telling you this is okay. In fact, this is what you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Well, what is going on? PTSD symptoms can include anxiety, nightmares, flashbacks. What triggers those mental and emotional reactions? What's happening inside of the brain?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, so so that we all respond as humans to threat in a particular way, which is to say that the amygdala in the brain is sort of the oversensitive alarm system, and it is designed to react kind of quickly, but not necessarily precisely.
Is that like the fight or flight?
Yes,
place?
Exactly. And but then we also have the prefrontal cortex, which acts more slowly but more accurately, right, and is able to kind of jump in and mediate and interpret what's going on. And you know, an example I would give is you're walking along and you see a stick on the ground, and for a second you say to yourself, it's a snake, and your body kind of reacts in a way that looks like a fear response. And then, you know, the kind of the prefrontal cortex part of your brain jumps in and says, no, it's a stick, it's fine, carry on. So that's the way that we are, you know, built to respond. The person with PTSD will have more activation in the amygdala. So studies have shown there's sort of more activation in the amygdala, the fight or flight piece, and less activation or underactivation in the prefrontal cortex. And so the world kind of seems more dangerous mm-hmm. to the person with PTSD than it might actually be.
So they're seeing a lot more snakes, or that
yes.
stick stays a snake a lot longer?
Oh, that's, I might say both, actually. I would mm-hmm. say there's just kind of like an over-attunement to the presence of threat and danger in the world.
So you said that the body feels this. What mm-hmm. are the effects on the body of PTSD?
Mm. There is, so I will say it's, you know, I myself am not an expert on the effects on the body. I'll just kind of talk a little bit basically about how the body is not meant to be constantly in fight or flight. You know, fight or flight is meant to be a real momentary kind of life-saving adaptive response. The person with PTSD spends more of their time in fight or flight than is optimal, right? And so a lot of stress hormones are flooding the body more than is ideal, and that tends to have, I'm just going to speak broadly, kind of long-lasting effects on the organs, on the heart, so on and so forth, on just kind of overall adaptive functioning.
So we talked a little bit about Jonathan Chase, the idea of the moral injury, and part of the things that he talks about is that what is one of the ways to counter that is the support from peers. Let's just hear a little bit of that.
Credentialed mental health professionals like me, in my view, have no place in center stage. It's the veterans themselves healing each other that belong in center stage. We're stagehands. Get the lights on, sweep out the gum wrappers, count the chairs, make sure it's a safe and warm enough place.
Now, I'm not treating him as a clinician, but I'm wondering about, is that something you abide by, this idea of creating a sense of comfort, a sense of warmth? How do you marry that kind of physical intimacy connection with the clinician's work?
Yeah, well, so one thing I will say, the program that I work in, Emory Healthcare Veterans Program, one of the things that I think we have found is that we are administering treatment in kind of a cohort. And so I'm working individually with one person, but that person's also going through treatment in a stepwise fashion alongside other vets who are also receiving treatment. And there are some groups that are part of our program. And I think there is a demonstrable effect of that support from their peers that they're getting that they wouldn't get, right? Just kind of coming to see a therapist once a week or something to that effect. So I'm not necessarily, I think, as on board with the idea that, you know, I'm a stagehand necessarily, but I think that both are important.
What would your role be in the whole production here?
You know, I think of myself in terms of the therapy that I do. I think I'm like a personal trainer. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm, you know, looking at my folks with PTSD who have kind of let their lives be very narrowed. You know, they've kind of isolated themselves. You know, they tend to avoid reminders. They tend to avoid crowds. They tend to avoid all of these things that for most of us kind of are part of a full life. And so a lot of what my role is to help them actually get back into that full life by approaching the things that they've been avoiding.
Liza Zwieback is with us. She's assistant associate clinical director at Emory Healthcare Veterans Program. So she's a lot of vets treating PTSD, first responders, military members. These are all people trained to be in these high stress environments. So what are some of the misconceptions we have about PTSD? It's a term we hear a lot.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think I heard you say before that there's a tendency to kind of lump everything into the category, the umbrella of PTSD, that if somebody has a trauma history, then boom, they have PTSD. And that is not so. In fact, most people actually have a trauma history. Unfortunately, most people don't have PTSD. And so actually resilience is the rule versus the exception. And so for a minority of folks who do experience something traumatic in their lifetime, they do go on to experience PTSD, but it is not as though just by virtue of having experienced something traumatic, a person develops any kind of psychiatric condition.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the interesting things to me. You just mentioned that, you know, a lot of people have trauma in their lives and there's multi-generational trauma. You talked about how the brain operates in the amygdala with someone with PTSD. But I understand that that can actually be carried on, those traits, from generation to generation. What do we know about that?
Yeah, and I will say this, it's a little bit outside of my wheelhouse, but my understanding is that there's been a lot of really promising research with animal models that suggest this kind of intergenerational transmission of the effects of trauma, which is really interesting. I think there's been some more theoretical work over the years kind of suggesting those effects in humans with Holocaust survivors and their children and successive generations. But I think there's a lot more to be discovered there.
What is the most effective way to treat PTSD? Oh,
that's a great question. There are several very, very well-supported methods for treating PTSD. So within the kind of the category of psychotherapy alone, there are, I would say, three empirically supported treatments, evidence-based treatments. And the one that I do the most of is called prolonged exposure therapy. And this is premised on the idea that, as I kind of mentioned before, people with PTSD tend to avoid things a lot. Mm-hmm. They avoid things that remind them of a traumatic event, of their traumatic event, that is. They avoid things that feel unsafe, even though objectively they're not unsafe. They avoid thinking and talking about their traumatic event from the past. And so what this avoidance does, unfortunately, even though it kind of works in the short term, really effectively, it perpetuates the symptoms. It maintains them, never actually allows people to get back into their lives, as I was talking about before. And so prolonged exposure therapy really jumps off from that premise.
Okay. And then CBT, the cognitive behavioral therapy, do you work in that realm as well?
Yes. And prolonged exposure is sort of within that CBT umbrella.
Okay. And we mentioned, Governor Brian Kemp in April signed the HOPE Act into law. This allows limited regulated production of medical cannabis oil. Some researchers think this drug and others like ecstasy and MDMA could help with PTSD. What does your research say?
Yeah. So actually, the MDMA piece is something that looks really promising and something that my colleagues are starting to study. And I would definitely agree with the reporter who was speaking before about the way that this is going to work. It's not a long-term treatment. It's not, in other words, people are not on MDMA
forever,
for any kind of prolonged period. But that being on a dose of it one or two times kind of has this persistent effect. Cannabis and cannabis oil, I think it's a little less clear, kind of from my understanding, what the mechanisms would be. One thing I will say, just with our patients, we actually prefer, and this gets a little controversial and a little difficult, we prefer that they not actually use cannabis because it gets in the way of learning these things that we need them to learn.
Liza Zwieback, thank you so much for speaking with us. I'm sorry you can't stick around to analyze the folks in the play that we're going to be speaking with in just a minute. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
She's Associate Clinical Director at Emory Healthcare Veterans Program. We're back with On Second Thought. This is Georgia Public Broadcasting, and I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier in the show, we talked about the insular culture of Navy SEALs, and you've probably heard about some of the heroic deeds carried out by this elite fighting force, killing Osama bin Laden or taking out the Somali pirates who hijacked Captain Mark Phillips' ship. But what would it be like to live with one? We hear plenty of stories about the sacrifices military spouses make, wives, in the case of Navy SEALs, but the wife's perspective is rarely at the center. The Hero's Wife is a play ending its run at the Synchronicity Theater in Atlanta this weekend, and it's an intimate look at how a couple deals with the invisible wounds of combat. Rebecca Robles plays Carissa, the young wife of retired Navy SEAL Cameron, played by Joe Sykes, and Rachel May directed the play, and they are all here with us this morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. Rachel, I want to ask you about the origins of the play. It was written by Aline Lathrop, and I guess she read about a Navy SEAL, and this inspired it all.
Yeah, she read an article called The Man Who Shot Osama Bin Laden Was Screwed, and it was, we had all lauded SEAL Team 6, and this article was about the man who ostensibly could have been the one who actually pulled the trigger on that shot, and he had no health insurance. He was now out of the service. He had not gotten his pension or his benefits. And there was some question as to why he left at 19 years, a year before that would have all happened. And it really talked about how, as a veteran who was one of the most lauded veterans of all time in our country, was now sort of left out in the cold and didn't really have anything.
Yeah, these are people who are just often held up on pedestals. Men used to being in the company of men, their strength, capacity, a lot of machismo. Joe, how did you, as an actor, embody that kind of backstory?
Oh, a lot of push-ups to begin with, and a little bit of creatine. But no, I I have one buddy at work who is this Army vet, and he told me about his experiences, and I actually had him read the play, and he said everything that's going on is spot on to what happens to people when they come back. The depression of not being able to leave your house because you're scared that something horrible will happen to you, that bubble of security that we all have in our society, it goes away when you experience that trauma, and it's hard to come back to it. And the anxiety of like going out to a bar and being like, there's too much noise, mm-hmm. too many people. And so talking to him was something that was really good. Just learning about PTSD was fascinating and very sad, and something that was easy for me to, you know, glam onto and sort of try to embody in this character.
Yeah. And there is a time, you know, there's a point when Carissa's trying to get him to go out, but he's like, well, this is too noisy out there. This is all set pretty much inside the walls of this home. There's, you know, a couple of little scenes outside. Mm-hmm. And Rebecca, you are carrying this kind of center role of Rebecca, of Carissa, rather. She doesn't have the experience of other good Navy SEAL wives. I think at one point, Cam calls her. She has no kids. She's really young, in her 20s. And really, they haven't known each other that long. Mm-hmm. Have they figured out how to communicate?
No. No, I mean, she's trying very hard. Yeah, it's interesting because we were reading articles about, you know, what it is to be a Navy SEAL wife and what that's like. And Carissa doesn't have that. She's new to this whole thing, mm-hmm. you know. So this is her first time dealing with with her husband coming back from war. Mm-hmm. And he's changed, which is interesting because he's done it a lot. But she can even tell that this time was different.
Yeah, they haven't known each other that long. What was their courtship?
Like
8 weeks. That's a respectable courtship. A line from the show, everybody.
Yeah. But a lot of their communication is while he's deployed is on Skype. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of remove. And then he's back in the house. Mm-hmm. And it's all very, very real. And it's a deeply intimate play in many ways. So for you, that domestic life, you know, they're talking about making dinner, wanting him to go out. He wants to stay home. They're playful. They're sexy. They're charming. At one point, now, Carissa is a yoga instructor. They do yoga together. We're just going to hear a little scene from that.
You don't know that one?
Can't.
Civilians.
Because you do yoga in the SEALs.
Of course we do yoga in the SEALs. Obviously more advanced than the rest of you. Come on. Downward facing platypus. You're not supposed to laugh at your instructor.
Oh, do I have to give you 10?
You don't want
to
know what you have to give me. I'll let this one slide. Downward facing platypus.
So there's so much going on in this little scene. You want to describe it for us, for the audience?
Yeah, so coming into this scene, Carissa had a bad night before. Uh-huh. I don't know how much I can say, but he had one of his...
We'll talk about the bad night.
Okay, yeah, Cam had one of his night terrors, and my character, Carissa, is choosing not to talk about it because she doesn't want to make things worse, really. She just wants him to adjust to being home. But she had a bad night, and so she's a little bit thrown off, and Cam is being his charming self and trying to figure out what's going on and warm her back up, and he does it very successfully by, you know, he doesn't know yoga. So by just being silly.
But daytime Cam is very charming.
Yeah, okay, so that's the thing. You know, there's like, there is a night and day difference here. And Rachel, I'm wondering like how you approach that as a director, showing this, like, you know, there's a kind of beautiful little warmth between them during the day, although it changes. And then at night, things just change.
Yeah, that's what drew me to the play, is that it really ricochets between this daytime life and nighttime life. And the nights are brutal and dangerous. And Cam is doing things that he doesn't know he's doing. Mm-hmm. And Carissa has a choice. She said, you know, she has to decide, am I going to tell him where the danger is? He might kill himself out of guilt, or something else might happen. Or can I find a way to get strong enough to meet him where he is in his brokenness, mm-hmm. and then find a way for us to get through this? And she works through and chooses the latter, which is a really powerful choice. And we see her strength grow throughout. So we really wanted the warmth and the heat and the sexiness and the intimacy to be at its absolute best. And we also wanted the violence to be at its absolute best. So we had both an intimacy director and a fight director on the show who worked on both of those areas, and started from the audition process of creating a process of consent between the actors, where they were constantly checking in with each other as we were working through to make sure that what we were doing was comfortable and safe, and these two actors are remarkable in this show, but they also, in the rehearsal process, were so good and careful at taking care of each other, both emotionally and physically, as we worked through that, which is really essential for them to do this 85-minute really powerful and amazing piece
it
together.
It is breathless on some level. Yeah. I mean, it just keeps going and going and going. There are just a series of scenes. And I think that there was something in the stage direction about that. You know, you may feel the tendency to want to pause, but don't.
Yes, and we don't.
Yeah, we try to never stop.
Yeah. Well, I would love to ask more about the violence coach, the intimacy coach, because so he flails at night, and you know, he's a jacked guy, and you're a jacked guy is what I'm really mean to say, Joe. But that's terrifying for Carissa, and I wonder what was like for you as an actor, Rebecca,
dealing with those scenes.
Yeah,
actually fun. I mean, I enjoy fight choreography, but no, it is scary. Like living through it. In the situation of it's not hard to act because it is scary, you know, having somebody throw you around and grab you by the neck and all of that. It makes it easy to do my job because it's happening. I mean, it's very safe and I trust Joe completely, but.
And you start to try and interact with him in his nightmares.
Yeah, she starts to kind of test things out a little bit. She's taking it into her own hands and
she becomes a bit of an investigator, right? Because she figures out, or won't tell too much about it, but she figures out a way to where she thinks can control it. And so she does try to start sparking these events so that she can learn what's going on in his head. She's really interested in finding
that out.
Because
he won't tell her anything.
But right. Why don't you tell him? You know, you don't tell, I'm sorry, you, Carissa. Why doesn't Carissa tell him what's happening? Because she shields him from it.
She does. And it's a good question. I think she chooses not to protect him. I think she knows he's not going to handle it well. Like, despite him being, you know, a professional fighter and being more mature and older than her in all these ways, she can also see that brokenness in him. And I think she knows he's not going to handle it very well.
That would destroy him, huh?
Yeah.
And Cam, the only thing of any value in his life is Carissa. He places her on a pedestal almost, and he would do anything for her, and for him to think that he is hurting her, well, he would just turn it on him. He would destroy himself if he found out that he was hurting her.
Well, there's so much on display, and there's so much that's concealed here, you know, that they'll wake up in the morning and she's trying to act normal, like everything's fine, and he doesn't tell him what's going on at night. I'm wondering what that's like, you know, to sort of contain that quiet inside of the characters. How did you work with them on that, Rachel?
Yeah, well, as we heard earlier in this segment, you know, this whole code of silence and the silent professionals is very much a code in the military in general, but in the SEALs very particularly. And the play has a few of those lines where Cam says, "You don't ask," and "silent professionals." And I think these wives are really used to having the men come back and not hearing anything. And their role when they're doing their Skype calls is to say, everything's fine, the house is good, everything's great. We read a bunch of articles about SEALs who came back from deployment and they got back at a different time than was expected. And the women had it, the wives sort of had it planned. They were going to get their hair done. The house was perfect. The baby was going to nap so that when they got to pick him up, but then he got in 2 hours early and they have to show up with no makeup on. The baby's screaming because they didn't get their nap. And that's not what they want to do. The wives want to present that everything's been fine and that they were not stressed by this deployment. But as Rebecca said, Carissa didn't have that practice. This is her first go at it. But she's still trying that. She's still trying to do all of those things to make it sort of perfect for him. So she's doing just as much to contain it as he is with containing what his experience was.
That's Rachel May. She's director of the play, The Hero's Wife. It's running through this weekend at Synchronicity Theater in Atlanta. Rebecca Robles is with us. She plays Carissa, the young wife of retired Navy SEAL Cameron, who is played by Joe Sykes, who is also with us. Well, she becomes this sort of cheerleader. There's another scene in the play, you know, she wants to make him marketable. She wants to help him put his skills to work. Let's hear just a little bit of that.
Other skills?
Sharpshooting.
Okay, not sure how to capture that.
How about jumping out of planes, sneaking up on ships?
Let's say athletic.
This was a stupid
idea. No, athletic is good. Let's just move on to your objective.
My objective?
Babe, you could do anything.
You could do anything. How does he feel? How does he feel in this new world?
Well, his skill set of a warrior, it doesn't apply in the community that he's in now. And that's something, this low self-esteem, where you, in this most dangerous place in the world, you were powerful and in control, and you knew your role and how to accomplish your goal. But now, it's like learning how to tie your shoes, being back in society. You don't know how to do it. Don't worry, folks, I can tie my shoes. but yeah, it's low self-esteem and a lack of value. Mm. That is something that, talking to my Army buddy, he was saying that's something that's real for veterans.
Yeah, and it's part of the attraction. I mean, they meet, they talk about how they met, and there's, mm-hmm. you know, this mm-hmm. beautiful scene that they evoke, and he basically jumps out of a plane, and he looks fantastic. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the attraction. So it's her attraction to him. It's hot. Mm-hmm. And maybe his attraction to himself on some level. So she's trying to, what, make him feel what?
That he still has value, even though he's not what he's not doing what he's done for his whole life, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Krissa sees all this potential in him, but he doesn't see it in himself. So.
And she wants to fix him.
Yeah,
she's,
yeah,
but there's something else. There's a transformation going on within her. Mm-hmm. How did you navigate that from, you know, the fresh wife, your husband's back home, to deepening that resilience, as Rachel called it?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that it's taken a while to figure out, but I think it's just there's a building frustration as we go along in the play of like, this isn't working. She keeps hitting these walls. And I think you have to get to that. She has to get to that point. There's no other way. Mm-hmm. And especially when we get to a scene where it becomes very clear that telling him would mean that he would probably, you know, commit suicide. So
yeah.
She also takes on some of his techniques, right? Mm-hmm. So in the SEALs, it's buds, not boot camp, right? And, mm-hmm. and Cam says, we run with a boat on our head and buds. Like, I mean, they literally like drown themselves. And I mean, the training is insane. And I think that Krissa tries a lot of her techniques and her tactics. I'm going to get his resume. I'm going to mm-hmm. give him self-empowerment. I'm going to tell him I value him. I'm going to be loving to him. And somewhere along the way, she realizes that those techniques are only going to go so far. And she also has to learn some of his techniques. And so I feel like it's her buds training. Like, we see her going through that strengthening and that mm-hmm. sort of, what are some of the strong responses that she can use that will actually speak to him in the way that he thinks.
Yeah.
I think sometimes this is a huge generalization, but as women, we go for the more sort of encouraging, loving, this is how it's going to work. And I think for Cam particularly, he's going to need a little bit more tough love in some instances. And so she mm-hmm. she really sort of learns some of those tactics
right.
from him.
It's an
so
adaptive
he doesn't
response.
Realize he's training her, but he is.
Yeah.
Well, this is something that Synchronicity has partnered on this play and in the past with United Military Care and Veterans Empowerment Organization, aiding in rehearsal process and also doing talkbacks. And I'm wondering what mm-hmm. kind of things you've heard from the talkbacks.
Do you guys want to talk about Sunday?
Oh, well, I mean, it was an honor. I forget the gentleman.
Tyler, from Veterans Empowerment Organization.
Yeah, I mean, when it was the inside scoop, so you get some ice cream and then we have a talk back. And so I got my ice cream and the guy comes right up and shakes my hand. And he's like, this was really great. And that's just an honor for him to say that to me. Mm-hmm. But in the audience, like many people, it was an older crowd on Sunday, but they were talking about their parents who were in World War II and how they would drink and they'd shoot that gun every once in a while and you wouldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
And that was back then, and here we are now. And so maybe we are making some advancements as far as a discussion, a conversation being held. But everyone said this is something that's around and needs to be discussed.
It was pretty fascinating how many people who worked on the show have direct family experiences. One of the people who worked on the show has a father who has hit her at night during one of these sorts of episodes, who's a veteran. One of the people on the show has a family member who walks outside the house at night drunk with a gun patrolling because of PTSD. And so, you know, just in our little 20 or so people who put the show together, we had a number of stories. And yet, I don't think culturally, we talk about it very much. And I don't think we really want to know. I don't think we want to know what's happening in these families. I think we want to clap at the airport when they walk through, and we want to cheer and be happy and say thank you for your service. But then we don't want to hear about it.
Well, it makes me think that also this is being acted out on theater where, you know, the ancient Greek tragedies about warriors coming home and their pain was a part of that was the cultural literacy of the time. What do you think? Or is this a way of kind of carrying on that tradition?
I think so. And one of the things, we've done a lot of shows at Synchronicity about war and about veterans. And one of the things that has always guided me is we worked with a psychiatrist who works with veterans years ago. And she said, you know, that in other cultures, there is a ritual for the warriors to lay down their warrior spirit when they come home from war. They go away from their families for several days and they lay down that spirit. And that in our culture, we don't have that. Literally, they get off the plane, their kids jump on them and hug them, and then the next day there's a family barbecue to celebrate them being back, and they're expected to be at the grill. And I don't think that's reasonable, and I don't think that is serving the men and women who are doing this for our country and who are protecting us and who are going through the ultimate sacrifice for us. And I think this play is really trying to show the very personal story that's behind that, and hopefully engender some empathy and compassion for those families and help us all think about that a little more.
Rachel May, she's director of the play The Hero's Wife. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And also with us, Joe Sykes, he plays Cam. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks.
And
for
Rebecca Robles, The Hero's Wife.
Thank you.
The play is running through this weekend at Synchronicity Theater. You can find more on it at gpbnews.org.